I'm Rachel, the creative director for Ram Dass's Love Serve Remember Foundation, and I'd like to welcome you to our Inner Academy, a virtual Dharma hall where our family of wisdom teachers will help you navigate your daily life by bringing ancient wisdom into a modern context. With over 200 hours of audio and video teachings, meditations, and practices from teachers like Ram Dass, Krishna Dass, Sharon Salzberg, Jack Kornfield, Roshi Joan Halifax, Joseph Goldstein, and many more, the Inner Academy is your core resource for finding balance, presence, and navigating the ups and downs of your daily life. The Inner Academy has guidance for every step of your journey. Choose from an annual or monthly membership and gain access to past and future courses, retreat replays, virtual community, and much more. If you've been familiar with Love Serve Remember Foundation for a while, you'll know that most of our offerings are given freely or on a sliding scale basis. So when you subscribe to the Inner Academy, you're paying it forward and bolstering our ability to continue creating accessible offerings for all in the future, as Ram Dass wished for us to do. Be here now and start your journey with Ram Dass's Inner Academy today. For more, visit ramdass.org/innerAcademy.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app today to get free delivery on your first three orders, while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
When we were with Maharaji, Ram Dass more than anybody would bring his doubt and his fears to Maharaji. He'd come right up and say, "I'm angry at people." Hardly anybody else did that. They tried to be the good devotee, but Ram Dass just let it hang out.
Yeah.
And it was such a great teaching because Maharaji always just kept showering love.
Hey everyone, it's Raghu. I'm back with Mind Rolling and a very old friend, Ram Dev Dale Borglum. Welcome.
Older by the day.
Yeah, really. We were just talking about that. But glad to have you here, Ram Dev.
It's always good.
Yeah.
As you were saying, very old, it reminded me that I never could quite figure out. I mean, there's all those stories that Ram Dass told about Maharaji being like ageless, that this like ancient woman showed up one day and she said, "Oh, he looks the same as he did when I was a little girl."
Yeah.
Right. So it was like implying that he was like over 100 years old. And then it seemed like maybe he's 80 years old or something. Did you ever figure that out or not?
No, I don't try and figure that out. Jesus, God. All I know is I think it was it wasn't. It was in the same house, Dada Mukherjee's house in Allahabad that we used to go to hang with Maharaji because he went there every winter. Church Lane, yeah. The one thing that stands out, like an elderly lady, very proper Hindu woman, she saw us, all of these hippies, all over the place, you know, women, everybody together. There was no decorum whatsoever. And right. She said, "Maharaji, you know, the women should be on one side and the men on the other." We got this through the translator. And Maharaji said, "They're from the West. They don't know anything. Leave them alone." Literally. "It's okay, Ma. They're from the West. They don't know anything." And here we are. We still don't know anything. That's the horror of it all. Yeah. So the other day I happened to... Ram Dev, for those of you who don't know who Dale is, he has two... You know, we all have two monikers, but he uses both of them. He has this wonderful institute, Living Dying Center.
Living Dying Project?
Project. Oh, okay. LivingDyingProject.org, right?
LivingDying.org.
LivingDying.org. I mean, and he has been doing this work around death, dying, and beyond that sort of very focused container. He takes it to another level, and he has been working over his lifetime with Ram Dass on all of that stuff and from the 70s and with
Stephen Levine.
Stephen Levine, and who we're going to refer to a little bit into this podcast a little bit more. And so this is tremendous work. Anybody out there who's in need of help, either directly because they have gotten a diagnosis that's pretty scary, or with loved ones, this institute is, I keep calling it an institute because it seems to me it's an institute.
I don't know why. It's never been an institute.
It's an institution that you've created. All right. It's
Actually, Stephen created it as part of the Hummel Foundation.
Oh,
That Ram Dass taught a workshop on the East Coast back in the 70s. Mm. And Elizabeth Kubler-Ross came as a student. And Stephen Levine was the meditation teacher.
Huh.
And Stephen and Elizabeth hit it off. She invited him to be the meditation teacher at her dying retreats. And then after a while, she got involved in like violent psychodrama and all this crazy new age, like beating up mattresses and screaming, "I hate you, daddy," and stuff, which didn't dovetail too well with Stephen's meditation. So she and Stephen amicably parted ways. I was living with Ram Dass in Soquel, right outside of Santa Cruz, and Stephen was living in Santa Cruz, and Ram Dass invited him to do what he was doing as part of the Hanuman Foundation, of which I was the executive director.
Mm.
So that was kind of the beginning of, quote, the conscious dying movement in America.
Yeah.
And the Living Dying Project website, livingdying.org, is the most complete site by far on the internet with information about dying and conscious dying and compassionate caregiving and all that kind of stuff. We have online workshops. I have a Saturday Zoom group with 270 people in it that's free.
Mm. Yeah. And you do something on Thursday. So it's very rich, and that's why I recommend anybody who's interested whatsoever to go over there and take a look. And Ram Dass does retreats with us as well, Love, Serve, Remember. And so I saw you. This is what struck me and why I called you to say, hey, let's just do something. Ram Dass doesn't even know what I'm talking about. But basically, you do something on IG, right? Instagram?
Yeah.
And I happen to see it. And, okay, so everybody out there, Ram Dass is, he went through Stanford with a statistics PhD.
PhD, pile right? higher and deeper.
Yeah.
BS so, is bullshit, MS is more shit, and PhD is piled higher and deeper. Oh, I went all the way.
You did. But it's like statistics, okay, everybody? It's not psychology, whatever. It's statistics.
It was actually mathematics, but that's okay.
Oh, really? Oh, okay. Yeah. I like that. And so what I heard as I tuned into the IG live thing last week, I guess, yes, was just this tremendous bhakti yoga talk, not bhakti yoga, but bhakti, in other words, heart thing around our guru, Neem Karoli Baba, Maharaji, we call him. And I'm going, wait a minute, because I'm, Ram Dass, you know, you really are in, you've been very connected to Buddhist teachings over your lifetime. You are very connected to the non-dual. And, yeah, you're a strange kind of amalgam there. Well, we all are, because that's our...
Strange amalgam. Ram Dass taught all that stuff. He was, like, all over the spectrum.
Yeah, but at the end, he disparaged Buddhists at the end. You know what he said?
No, I don't know what he said.
He said, the thing is about our Buddhist friends is... And he wasn't talking about his close friends, Jack, Joseph, and Sharon, and Roshi. He was just, in general, the reality that is presented, particularly by the Tibetans, he said, it was so crystal clear, just absolutely a beautiful container, and it would catch your mind in an instant and maybe bypass your heart. That's what he used to say. So,
yeah, I don't agree. I don't agree with a lot of things that guy said.
I know. But you don't. Every time we talk about Ram Dass, you go, well, I'm not sure I agree about that.
he and I both got PhDs at Stanford. We did have a really kind of, not really competitive, but a bit of a contentious intellectual relationship. And I was one of the people that tried to get him to kind of, I mean, I could tell you stories. I don't know if that's what this podcast is about, but just as one example. You know, I'm living with him, and every time he would teach a lecture, he'd get like really stoned. He'd just like smoke hash or whatever. And he'd kind of go like floating out on the stage. I said, Ram Dass, there's a whole generation of young people who think that this like really stoned guy, that's what spiritual is, right? Why don't you try going out there once and not being stoned and just see? He said, no, I can't talk nearly as well. You know, I need the marijuana to really open my heart. So just try it. Just try it.
Yeah,
and he didn't. He liked it. And I thought, oh, they still love me. Even if I'm not stoned. He's like, shocked.
Oh, God. All right, I won't. Yeah, let's not go further into that reality. I feel the same way, by the way. I'm way more loquacious when I can have a toke here and there. So
is that why you're so loquacious right now?
Not right now. It's too early. But oh, boy. All right, so. Anyhow, you did this wonderful talk about Mahanaim Karoli Baba, and I was sort of surprised. I was expecting something else, and it led me to think about it a little bit and remember something, and I'm going to read it to you from our friend Bob Thurman.
Okay.
Right. Bob, who's a close friend of His Holiness the Dalai Lama and taught at Columbia for a long time. So it was, I guess somebody had a question about the word guru. So here's what he said. The word guru, he said, is in the original Sanskrit actually means, quote unquote, heavy. Do you ever know that? It's amazing.
No.
It has a paternalistic history and connotation. True. The heaviness sits on your forehead. It's the authority you submit to in the family and in the caste and in the culture. In Tibet, they changed the word to lama, which has more of the meaning of chief or teacher, the real guru. Thurman continues, suddenly becomes very intense. The real guru is your own intelligence.
Right.
Right. See, this is what I thought you'd be talking about the other day. He looks at the woman in the audience and repeats the phrase, your own intelligence. In some forms of Buddhism, he explains, they made a new concept called a Kalyana Mitra in Sanskrit.
Right.
Which means something like spiritual friend, someone who cares about you enough to guide you in a good direction, someone who is motivated by love. The good guru, Thurman emphasizes, puts the responsibility back on you. If you find one who says, oh, you finally returned, now you are home, I have it all, this is a one-stop shopping, give me everything you have, make sure to leave that guru behind. Run for the hills. Their agenda is not your agenda. So I made a note about, I actually, this book was in a book, do you know, this great book, Mark Epstein, the Buddhist psychologist, psychotherapist.
Course, yeah. Yes,
Mark, who's a wonderful person. And I did a podcast with him some time ago, and I had remembered this, and I made a note about, gee, I wonder, because I never really talked to him about it, nor have I talked to Bob, but I'm going to get a chance because we're doing a retreat and Bob's going to be in it at the end of August, and we're going to talk. It's about the intersection of bhakti and Buddhism. And yeah, I just, how do we characterize our relationship with Maharaji, with Neem Karoli Baba, related to many of the truths that Bob expresses in this little passage?
big question.
The big question, isn't it? I mean, really it is. Platitudes come up one after the other with a question like this, right? Spiritual platitudes.
Okay, but I think it's a kind of related to that, even that thing you were saying before about how Ram Dass said that a lot of people get into Buddhism and they kind of bypass the heart.
Yeah.
That, like, at least in Tibetan Buddhism, which has more heart in it,
yeah.
Traditionally, somebody begins at the beginning and you do 100,000 prostrations and a million mantras and you do the Nundro practice and you, before you start doing the heart stuff, you do a lot of preparation before you get to Tantra and to non-duality. But because it's the West, anybody's got $35, you go in, you give the Lama, you get the empowerment, you do the thing, you know, and people want the shortcut. And the Lamas say, well, if you got the $35 here, well, we'll give you the teaching. And I'm not saying it's a mistake, but Maharaji was not a Kalyan Mitra. He was not a spiritual friend. He was consciousness itself. I've been around a lot of great teachers, a lot of Tibetan teachers, Kalu and Dujin Rinpoche and Karmapa and all those people. The only person I ever felt was close to Maharaji was Anandamayi, to his level of awakening. And
I actually, I'll just say, I thought the same of 16th Karmapa.
16th Karmapa,
sure.
Too.
Yeah,
I would agree with that. When he would do that black hat ceremony, shake the universe.
Yeah.
Okay, so it's so difficult, Raghu, because it just seems to me that Maharaj is so different from all the other stuff we're talking about, because he wasn't part of a lineage or a tradition. I mean, you know, he loved Hanuman, he was Hanuman, whatever, but he didn't push that on us, really. I mean, it
Christ is what he pushed, big time.
He gave me a Christian mantra, and I was trying to, I went to India to get away from Christianity.
Yeah.
And for the last 50 years, I've been saying this Christ mantra.
It's perfect.
Yeah, well, I guess it is. But so there's the Upaguru and the Satguru. Maharaji was the Satguru. And I don't think he's any different from every other teacher in the sense that it is that, what was the term that Bob Thurman used there? That inner wisdom or inner knowing or something? What was the word you used there? Toward the end?
Well, he says it's the real guru is your own intelligence.
Your own intelligence.
Yeah.
Okay. So, you know, when I was with Maharaji and for years and years after, I would dream about him and I would feel his presence. And then all of a sudden, maybe not a sudden, but like pretty quickly, he disappeared. And for a year or two, I thought, I must be a bad devotee. You know, I wasn't saying the mantra enough. I'm a bad boy. He's left me. And then I got this message. He said, I'm here, but it's time for you to get out of the nest. It's time for you to use your own wings. I'm not going to be holding your hand in that way. It's like you got the transmission. You know the stuff. Now you got to live it. You just go out there and do it. It's fine. You know, I'm here. And so many people come and say, oh, you're so lucky you met Maharaji and I didn't. And in a way, yeah, good karma and all that. But at the same time, I really remember what Joseph Goldstein said at the first summer at Naropa when we dragged him into a Guru Purnima, which, you know, he's like the least devotional person, high being you're ever going to meet. And I'm not saying that in any disparaging way. He said, Maharaji must have been such a great teacher because he has all the most difficult students. and that those of us that really needed the advanced training had to get our butts to India and get hepatitis and malaria and dysentery. I mean, there's a lot of people who are just as close to Maharaji that didn't have to go to India, you know, that he's firmly implanted in their hearts. And
I actually, by the way, have proof of that.
Okay, I'd like to hear it.
And this is in the form of a little bit of a commercial. This book, Whisper in the Heart.
Is that a book or is that a poster you've got there?
No, it's a book.
You've got the whole book?
Yeah, I've got the advance, the only advance copy. It's coming out August mid 16th or something. But
written
this,
by your ex-wife. So
mother of my children, I call her. And it is stories of people's encounters with Neem Karoli Baba after he left that body in 1973 in September. And when you go through it, you stop thinking so much of that, what that thing, I mean, it's a beautiful thing with that blanket and everything. It's just, you know, it's phenomenal. But that thing is beyond that. You start to understand that when you read these stories that are nothing to do with him being in a body or not. They're the same as what Ramdev and I experienced back then. So it starts to engage with what Robert Thurman is saying in terms of universal intelligence is one good way to characterize what that thing there is. People call it God, Buddha nature, whatever. It's got many, many, many different names.
Right.
And in this case, he was not a teacher. He is not a teacher, except he is a vast teacher in terms of understanding that everything, it's like Ram Dass's grist for the mill. Everything is just perfectly designed. If you can just move your me aside a little bit to know that everything is perfectly designed for you to be free of that mini self eventually. And that is, to me, the paramount description of what a real teacher is and a real guru. And in this case, I'm going to continue that discussion with Bob when I meet up with him at the end of next month.
So, but going back to that thing that Ram Dass said, that a lot of Buddhists bypass the heart.
Yeah.
You know, to me, each path has its own strengths and weaknesses. I mean, if you look at Hare Krishna people, they go right into the heart, but they bypass being grounded and centered and being in their bodies.
Yeah.
And what Maharaji did is he didn't have one path. He was all paths. I mean, if you look at how people have practiced after they've left him, there's the Tibetan Buddhists like Danny and Tara, and there's Zen people and Sufi people and Christian people. And I think each of us have had to find our own way. Whereas if you're like into Soto Zen like Suzuki Roshi, or you're into the Dalai Lama's school of Tibetan Buddhism like Bob Thurman, there's a real prescribed path that takes you from point A to point B to point C. And there is the danger in Buddhism that it's so beautiful intellectually that, you can just jump into that part. But basically, Vajrayana Buddhism is a tantric path. And tantra is really tricky if you don't have a teacher. Because when you start seeing it's all God, it's all the face of the mother, it's all the manifestation of Shakti, then so is drinking whiskey, and so is screwing your students, and so is whatever you want, right?
Yeah.
And a lot of these Tibetan teachers have come over, they got in all kinds of trouble. I'm not going to mention any names, but you can mention almost any Tibetan Lama.
Not just Tibetans. I mean, many, many teachers from the East get lost over here. Or over there. I mean, it doesn't really matter. Just that's a fact.
But the point I'm making here is that the tantric path, and Maharaji was a tantric teacher. He kept saying, it's all God. What's the best form to worship God? Every form. I mean, that's the tantric teaching. Feed everybody. You don't have to do all kinds of complicated yoga.
Yeah.
And without having somebody to kick you in the butt when you start getting stuck in a place. It's really easy to be deluded. And these teachings, these Tibetan teachings, are very, very powerful teachings, but almost nobody has the gift of you're in an ongoing sangha where there's somebody who's really guiding your unfolding. So that's why I keep coming back to Maharaji, where he just says, feed everybody, love everybody. He didn't encourage us to meditate. He didn't encourage us. I mean, like, I had just been studying math for 10 years at Berkeley and Stanford, and my mind was a complete, utter shambles. And I heard Goenka is going to be doing some courses. I said, Maharaji, can I go study with the Buddhists? He said, if you like. He was not particularly enthusiastic about it. If you like, you know.
But when he wanted to get rid of us, he would say, you go into the course? In English, he'd go, course? Keep moving.
Yeah.
And right. Yeah. Oh, boy.
So, I mean, it's an interesting question, but Raghu, it's really, to me, it's like, it gives me a headache, the question you're trying to get me to answer. It's like, all I know is, I love Maharaji. I love you. I'm at a point in my life. I've got so many great teachers and teachings that now it's coming through me. I can give it back. What a blessing. And there's always enough money. There's always enough joy. And, Ram Dass had that stroke. And I knew him as well as anybody. I lived with him in various places. We worked together. And I kind of despaired as, how is he going to get through this last place where he's so caught? And the stroke did it. You know, I mean, it really, one would think, here was the most articulate guy in the West talking about spirituality. Yeah. He could talk it better than anybody. He brought so many people to the Dharma by taking these like beautiful concepts and putting them in words that anybody just walking in off the street could say, wow, that's what I've been looking for all my life. Yeah. Now I get it. Yeah. And all of a sudden he can't talk hardly, right? And what that put him through. But that's how much Maharaji loves us, that whatever it takes, if you say you want freedom, you've come to Maharaj and said, I want to be free. I've said, I want to be free. And look at all the shit that's happened in our lives. That's like, I remember once when I was living in Santa Cruz, right before I moved into this house with Ram Dass, I came to my altar and I said, Maharaji, my life is pretty balanced now. I want to be free. Whatever it takes, just bring it on. And 3 days later, I come crawling back to altar, said, maybe we need to slow down a little bit here. I can't deal with it. What are you doing to me? Right?
Oh, that's so great, really.
Well, it wasn't so great.
Oh, come
at the
on,
time.
God. Oh, come on. Oh, boy. I have something else here to move into. I mean, my own take about, I understand what Thurman is saying, and Trungpa Rinpoche, who I have something else from him that's interesting, in terms of Kalyan Mitra, you know, a friend, and I have no relationship with that whatsoever regarding Maharaji, but I certainly fully understand the value of it regarding a teacher, someone who's pointing the way, not is the way, and I think because of the abuse in the West that has people have come to under the tutelage of many different teachers, that cautionary tale and the way that Robert is characterizing it, I think is really important, actually.
Yeah, very much.
Yeah. Just moving a little ways away, if I can. Now, everybody out there, this is something from Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche, both Ramdev and I have known. And I don't think we've really talked about Trungpa, you and I, lately, but I appreciate him enormously, notwithstanding the pushback that he has gotten over the years. Because of his social activities, shall we say. And but I don't think there's hardly any more astute translator of the teachings, the Tibetan teachings that I've ever read, except, you know, for Trungpa. I don't know if you agree or not about
Completely
that.
Completely agree.
Okay. So somebody asked him, do you have to be aware of death in order to actually be alive? So this is right up, you know, your alley. He said, I don't think you have to be particularly aware of death in the sense of analyzing it, but you just have to see what you are. Often we tend to look for the positive side, the beauty of spirituality, and ignore ourselves as we are. This is what I love about him so much. This is the greatest danger. If we are engaged in self-analysis, our spiritual practice is trying to find some ultimate analysis and ultimate self-deception.
Right.
Ego's intelligence is tremendously talented. It can distort anything. If one seizes on the ideas of spirituality or self-analysis or transcendence of ego, immediately ego takes hold of them and translates them into self-deception.
Right.
Is that great?
He was brilliant. And another thing he said was that until one comes into intimate contact with death, your spiritual practice will have the quality of you being a dilettante.
Mm, mm-hmm.
So he didn't say until you really think about death a lot or you intellectualize it or your ego really understands it, but you come into intimate contact. And intimate means beyond the ego. It's like, you know, two balloons rubbing, two bodies rubbing, that you're that close to death, that you know in the marrow of your bones you're going to die. Until you know you're going to die, that spiritual practices, you can get a more efficient ego structure, a better class of sexual partners, maybe make a little more money, right? Why are you laughing so
really
much for
good.
That one? I don't know why. Why did Raghu laugh?
I don't know.
So we were at Naropa, right? And the first summer at Naropa, it's a big deal. It's the first Buddhist university in America. And a couple of things that Trungpa said. The first thing is he had a faculty meeting. And he said, this is a big deal. This is the first Buddhist university in America, but we're not doing this for ourselves. We're not even doing this for our children. We're doing this for our children's children.
Really?
And I thought that was like such a beautiful thing. And then one night he gave this talk. He was up on the stage, you know, there's like 1,000 people. And he has a carafe next to him that looks like water, but it's sake. And he's like drinking the whole time. And at the end of the talk, I walked outside. And the talk had been so brilliant, I could literally see each leaf of each tree glowing with consciousness. But when he stood up from his talk, he fell over on his face.
No.
And he had a paper that was making the rounds there called On Conscious Drinking. And what he said is, if you really hold awareness as you're getting high with alcohol, you don't get drunk in the same way. So I was living with Tara, and we got a big bottle of sake. She was a dynamite meditator. We put this bottle of sake down between us. We started meditating, and every 10 minutes or so, we'd take a big slug of sake, right? And at the end of an hour, I felt like I was on acid. My ego was completely dissolved. My mind was crystal clear. And I got up to pee and I could barely walk because my body was drunk. But my mind was not. And I think the reason, this may sound like an excuse for his crazy wisdom stuff, but he was teaching when there was a lot of preciousness in spiritual life.
Mm.
People had their white clothes and their beads and their holy names and that. And he was showing you that it doesn't have to be precious. He said, meditate a lot, take care of your body, and do whatever you want to do. And so his followers, they were having orgies, really, if you get right down to it, and drinking like crazy. But then there's the Saturday morning meditation. And if you've been drinking the last night and you got a hangover and you're there for 3 hours sitting in front of them, it's like hell. So people began to come to a more balanced life. Not because he said, don't do this, don't do that. Maharaji rarely said, don't do something. Somebody said, should we smoke dope? He said, well, it'll heat up your mind and it's bad for the heart. But if you want to do it, do it. You know, he would never be telling people not to do things. And Trungpa didn't either. I thought there's a very wise way of getting people to come to the Dharma on their own rather than trying to push them and force them.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. By the way, everybody, and we'll put it in the show notes, but this, if you're on YouTube, is Cutting Through Spiritual Materialism. It's one of his most essential books in my mind.
Yes.
So go get it. So one of the other thing that occurred to me is one of the greatest things of about Ram Dass, since we've been talking about him a little bit, is self-honesty.
Yeah.
And we all came to that as soon as he started talking about his own BS, we started to relax, at least I did, and I know many people, same thing. You start to relax a little bit. It's okay. We're human. You don't have to, you know, want to cut your throat because you had a dark thought. And I really appreciate what he transmitted around that to me is some of the most important part of his teachings. Here's just something from another book that we have, by the way, Ram Dass' Words of Wisdom. It's a wonderful book. The art of growth has to do with how quickly you admit error. Mm-hmm. We always make decisions from where we're sitting. Then that decision leads to a new moment. And then in the new moment, you listen again. And often you realize that the new moment suggests that the previous decision just led you into a new moment in which there is another decision that isn't going to be consistent with the last one. To the extent that you keep coming back into the existential situation with the trust that if you keep listening in the moment, and keep being true to what you hear. While people may be upset with you because you are not consistent, you will stay as close to the truth as you hear it. Mm. That's what you can offer the universe. That's actually fairly complex in its execution, I would say.
Subtle.
Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, when we were with Maharaji, Ram Dass, more than anybody, would bring his doubt and his fears to Maharaji. He'd come right up to him and say, "I'm angry at people." Hardly anybody else did that. They tried to you know, be the good devotee, but Ram Dass just let it hang out.
Yeah.
And it was such a great teaching because Maharaji always just kept showering love, you know, and he got so angry at Tukaram once, he threw a plate of food at Tukaram right in front of Maharaji.
Yeah, right? Yeah, famous story.
I didn't have the balls to throw any food at anybody in front of Maharaji at that point.
And so, I know, and you think about it, yeah, wow.
He just let it hang out. And I mean, in a way, when I read that whole book, Being Ram Dass, there's a lot of new things I hadn't known about his early life. And then, the second half of the book, I pretty much knew almost all that stuff. But what really struck me was from early childhood to the end of his life, he was focused on the truth. How can I be awake now? You know, all the way from prep school to Harvard to Tim Leary to on and on and on to Ram Dass to the whole thing. There was this underlying focus on, even when he was despairing and depressed or when he was taking like massive amounts of psychedelics, it was all in the service of, I want to find the truth. I want to be here.
Yeah. The roadmap to consciousness is how he expressed it. But it's, wouldn't you say, aside from, obviously, this was a big, big piece of grace he got that he transmitted to the West, this just being honest with yourself. Wouldn't you say, to me, it is such a priority to be on the so-called spiritual path, to have that kind of honesty, because the ease at which we all fall into spiritual bypass is extraordinary. And the antidote to that is having, I mean, which is why mindfulness is very important. Give us a little shot around that, mindfulness.
Well, I've had COVID and I've been kind of weak. And I remember I was meditating a couple of weeks ago. I was having a really nice meditation, whatever that means. And all my mind was pretty calm. And a thought came floating up. It wasn't like a big thought. It was just like a kind of a little floater. And I kind of pushed it aside. I wanted to go back to the spaciousness. Mm. And I just saw how there was just the slightest judgment. It was so subtle. You know, like if I wouldn't have been meditating, if I would have been out and about, I wouldn't have even have noticed it at all. Mm. And even though we were talking earlier in our conversation about how Buddhism, you can bypass the heart.
Yeah.
At the same time, you do need to have that mindfulness to begin to notice the ways that you're not entirely kind with yourself. And that with the talking about Ram Dass being so, has so much self-honesty, to me, that requires a great deal of compassion, a great deal of compassion. And compassion is not born when you're at the retreat or something. Compassion is born in that simple moment where you've just noticed that you've gotten lost in your mind. Can you come back to being present through the heart rather than kind of there's some jerking, there's some slight violence, that there's always a sense of mercy, of tenderness, maybe a fierce tenderness, but there's a tenderness in your relationship with yourself. And the Dalai Lama on his third visit to America said, now I'm beginning to understand, it makes me so sad, you Americans don't like yourselves, mm-hmm. right? So that we're starting this big project of disidentifying with the ego structure, the way that Trungpa was talking about, and identifying with basic intelligence or true nature or God. From the standpoint of you don't like yourself, it gets incredibly messy and convoluted very quickly until we have enough mindfulness to be with those almost automatic pushings away of where we're caught. And to me, what's kind of missing in Buddhism and is one of the main focuses on the way I teach meditation is embodied mindfulness, getting grounded and centered, inhabiting the lower chakras. I was talking to Mirabai Starr at the Maui retreat in December, and she said that, you know, she knew Ram Dass back in the day at Lama, and he was teaching a lot there. And he said something that she actually found in her notes or a tape of it or something, where he said, we're going to start spirituality on the fourth chakra because the first three are too dangerous. we're going to start with the heart, but that's not going to work. Mm. And eventually, I mean, he came to that understanding too, obviously. I'm not saying that he was, but that was just a temporary thing. Moment. But like until you really inhabit the first three chakras that have to do with fear and guilt and shame, there won't be a foundation to bear the utter vulnerability of the spacious heart. So the heart can be open if the environment is really supportive. But if somebody's like being mean or you're having a hard time or something, and you don't have that foundation of mindfulness, embodied mindfulness, then the heart's going to be opening and closing all the time.
Yeah, and reacting. And I think that the same way we talk, or Ram Dass talked about it, we've been talking about it, how Buddhists, because of the beautiful crystalline clarity of their version of reality, or the version of reality, they bypass the heart because you're so susceptible. This is the West. Our minds are who we think we are. At the same time, people who are going through the heart and not at all interested in what we might call viveka, discriminating wisdom. Mm-hmm. I think that we were given that from Maharaji, the combination of these, how he, he did not say, go meditate, although he's, hey, go to the course, get out of here, get rid of us. But at the same time, the teachers that he praised the most were Buddhist teachers.
Really?
That I can, I mean, talked really, Kalu Rinpoche being one of them.
Yeah.
Who he's basically, this my little the miracle story where he told me I'd be seeing Kalu Rinpoche without directly going, you're going to be with some Tibetans. They're going to give you teachings. Never happened to you before. Are you sure? No, Maharaji, I never met a Tibetan. I was on my way to Delhi to get a new passport. And when I went to the consulate, Canadian consulate, I said, are you letting in, is Canada letting in refugees from Tibet? And he said, yeah, as a matter of fact. And he went like that. And then in walked Kalu Rinpoche from another room with a retinue of monks. And I ended up in a room where people were interviewing him from the CBC. And he was bored with them. And as soon as they said, well, why don't you ask a question? I got darshan, which Maharaji said, you have darshan for 40 minutes with Tibet Lama? No. Yes. And that happened. And I know a number of other people here's this thing with Krishnadas and I went one day and he had a bad knee and Maharaji took the pain from, all of this stuff happened, except what was more interesting was Krishnadas had a diary. Something
are you saying that Kalu came to Maharaji and it?
No.
Who had a bad knee?
Krishnadas.
Oh.
He had the bad knee.
Okay.
And we went, and nobody was seeing, Maharaji wasn't seeing anybody, but we went anyhow. They let us in. He fixed the knee, but the real thing was he had a diary, his diary with him, and Maharaji grabbed it and started looking through. And then he turned to the page, Mahamudra page, right? And he said, he told the translator, just translate some of this. And he did, and he went, teak. That's exactly, yes, right on. There were many instances where there was references, even to the point, that famous story Krishnadas tells where Maharaji said to him out of the blue one day, courage is a very important thing. And right. Then Barman, one of the great devotee of Maharaji, said, no, but this is the path of bhakti, grace, guru's grace. Like he's countering Maharaji turned back to Krishnadas and said again, courage is very important. So in many ways, the combination, we were given the reality of discriminating wisdom through what, however, each person's lens was a bit different, to go along with the open heart thing and to go along with Ram Dass saying, I went to Thailand or Burma and did a meditation retreat for 3 months. Then I could start to open my heart because
right.
I could have a focus. So the way in which they work together to me seems a gift that this legacy offers.
Literally though, in Tibetan Buddhism, the two pillars are wisdom and compassion, both. And compassion without wisdom is mushy.
Yeah.
And wisdom without compassion is brittle. And so that we're always balancing. Am I getting too mushy? Am I getting too kind of heartfelt without discriminating wisdom? Or am I getting too much into the wisdom and don't have the connected, spacious heart thing happening?
Yeah.
And I've been with Tibetan lamas. I remember I was at a Dzogchen retreat once with Chögyal Rinpoche. And at the beginning, he did some puja, to bring in the deities and whatever. And he was, he's this like very wonderful meditation teacher. And as he was doing the ritual, the tears were just streaming down his face. He was feeling so much love for the Dharma, so much love for the lineage, that his face was covered with tears.
Mm. Yeah. I remember Ram Dass once said he was in a car with a bunch of Trungpa acolytes, whoever they called themselves, and they were going on about.
Whatever they called themselves, Rago, get it cleaned up.
Oh, no, I can't. They were talking about Trungpa, their teacher, in a manner that was absolutely no different than Ram Dass thought, the way I talk about Maharaji, right. With such great reverence, devotion, and so on, it's all one. Last but not least is I think we all say many a time, you're going to meditate yourself into enlightenment and you're going to keep trying to do it, you know, to many people who get on the path and that's what it's about. And I know we all pretty much say the same thing. It's about how kind can you be? You know, how compassionate can you be? How much love can you share and radiate? And I found this thing from somebody I don't know at all, Christian Dillo. I want to give him a little credit here, a Zen person. And he defined the practice of kindness as making space and adding a little bit of warmth. Somehow that tickled me.
That's so great.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
But that's ultimately what it's all about, as far as I'm concerned, to be able to.
That whole thing about kindness, though, I mean, once again, I know I sound like I'm a contrarian. But
you are a contrarian.
So the kindness thing is the one place I don't entirely agree with the Dalai Lama.
Kindness is my only religion.
Kindness is my religion. I think sometimes maybe it's just a matter of language and translating and things, but sometimes compassion is not sweet. Sometimes compassion is fierce. Sometimes, I mean, we're good at saying yes with an open heart and no with a closed heart, but can we say no with an open heart? If you're a parent and you say yes to your child all the time, you're going to raise a monster, right? I mean, we really, Maharaji at times is incredibly fierce. He's like yelling at people, huh?
At times?
Yeah, at times. And at times he was incredibly tender. And at times he was both. So and there's a lot of young Tibetans who are kind of pissed off at the Dalai Lama because he let instead of having, dealing with the Chinese in a more kind of asymmetrical anti-terrorist way or whatever, he just says, oh, let's the non-violence, let the Chinese take over Tibet, which was maybe supposed to happen. I mean, what did Padmasambhava say like 1,500 years ago? Something like, when the Dharma comes to the land of the red... No, he said, when the iron bird flies and the iron horse runs on rails, the Dharma will come to the land of the red man. Mm. And so... clearly, the Dharma was supposed to be spread, and the Chinese, all the horrible things they've done there in Tibet, helped create that. Mm. But I don't know. I mean, to me, Hanuman is Shiva. And they say that Hanuman is the deity that most quickly gives you darshan, Hanuman and Durga, because they're both beautiful. One's a cuddly monkey, one's a beautiful woman. But Hanuman is Shiva and Durga is the same as Kali. But Shiva and Kali, you know, hey, and I don't want to get too close to that hot stuff, right? Mm. And I had Hanuman's darshan once. He actually showed up in my bedroom. And the feeling was when he looked at me, it was like the most sweet, tender love combined with all the strength of the universe. There was that Shaivite thing that, like, he could cut through anything, and yet he was this tender, loving monkey.
Absolutely. Well, I'm going to take it down one notch before we got to go.
Okay.
And that around kindness, I guess I'm much more thinking of a more compassion is much it's a broader, more complex idea, and it whereas I guess what I'm talking about with kindness is just the literal walking across the street and someone falls and you can do nothing but help pick that person up.
Of course.
Just getting out of thinking of oneself all the time. Kindness is actually thinking, oh, wow, maybe there's somebody else around me that needs some support. You get interrupted by a phone call. Somebody's going through something. A friend,
right.
It's a neighbor. You know, just a basic goodness thing, and that's why I think that's an aspiration for everybody.
Okay.
To become kinder.
Is there time for one short little thing here?
Absolutely.
Okay.
It's a podcast. The sponsors will be, you know, we'll have to send them over to you too.
So I was just telling some of this story yesterday. It just popped in my mind. I haven't thought of it for a long time. But I had this woman in one of my groups who was very open. She was maybe too open. She'd had some abuse earlier in her life. But she had this like remarkable spiritual openness and availability. And she revealed in the group that she had gone to this doctor and he put the make on her. And it was really hard for her. And she told him to stop and he wouldn't stop. And he would follow her to events and things like that. She'd go to Eckhart Tolle and he'd come or something like that. No, Adyashanti. And I said, I'll deal with it. What's your doctor's name? She told me his name. And I called up the office and said, this is Dr. Dale Borglum from the Living Dying Project. And I'd like to talk to Dr. So-and-so. The guy got on the phone and I said, I just want to tell you that I'm very good friends with so-and-so. And if you don't leave her alone, I'm going to get your license taken away. I'm going to make it happen. Let me tell you again, you're going to lose your license if you bother her one more time. Hmm. Okay. So is that being kind? Is that, I mean, to me that kind, I mean, there's a difference between being kind and being nice. I mean, sometimes kind, I thought it was being kind to her by being fierce with him.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Nice is a whole other category of me. Okay. I'm being kind is just an altruistic impulse that is beyond your mind. You just
But I'm sure
there.
That doctor didn't think I was being kind to him.
Well, absolutely. But I think ultimately, you never know. He might have come to his senses, right? You never know.
Yeah.
So, but you're kind. You've been kind to me. Our whole, Ramdev and I were with everybody else back in the day. And it's going on a lot of decades at this point. So I appreciate it. I appreciate you being here right now. Be here now. Talk about
it. It's a pleasure. It's always a pleasure.
So
great. I mean, the satsang are people I've known longer than anybody except for a couple of cousins.
Yeah. Yeah, right. It's amazing, isn't it? Talk about...
And next year is going to be 50-year anniversary of Maharaji leaving his body. 50 years.
Really? Amazing. That's right. Wow. Amazing, amazing. Well, everyone, this is Mind Rolling on Be Here Now Network. Go to BeHereNowNetwork.com. And by the way, Ramdev has a wonderful podcast on the network. And I'm not being kind. It is very important. And what he brings to the table, and I thank you, I truly mean this, for being part of the
network. It's called Healing at the Edge.
Healing at the Edge, yeah. So take advantage. You'll see everything we've been talking about. Some of it will be in the show notes, and there'll be links and so on. And I don't, are you writing the book, or is that still not?
Well, happening? Just between you and me, Parvati's helping me write the book.
Oh, okay, great. All right. Wonderful. So everybody, we shall see you next week. On Mind Rolling.
Lots of love, Raghu.
Thank you.
Ram Ram. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.